From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 35 for Friday, the 22nd of July, 2011. On the show this week...
But I would love to create a performance piece where the audience are actually immersed in the music, so that in some way that you have 360 surround speaker system, and that maybe in some way I can actually direct sound at you.
Earlier this week, Imogen Heap reached into our skulls with a pair of futuristic gloves, caressed our grey matter, and then utterly blew our minds at our Wired Future of Music event. She'll be joining us on the show later to discuss how, as will Paul Smanitsky, director of digital at Universal Music Group, to discuss his thoughts on how musical consumption is evolving. That's all coming up after this week's glissando of Wired News. Hello, I'm Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me on the doorstep of tomorrow, senior staff writer Duncan Gear.
Hello.
Hey, and associate editor Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
We are all blown in terms of how our minds are feeling at the moment because Imogen Heap did some rather amazing stuff last night.
She was really good, wasn't she?
Yeah. I'm still, you know, that feeling of waking up and thinking, did I just dream that? That's almost how I felt.
It was an incredibly spectacular performance, and we're talking to her a little bit later on. But what she did, do you want to sort of describe a little bit about what she did on stage?
She had these gloves that had sort of like accelerometers in them and
microphones and all sorts.
They knew where they were in space and whether her fingers were like making a fist or open and whether they were at 90 degrees above her head and things like that, and could manipulate music that she was recording and looping in real time by the position of her hands, where she was standing on the stage. Everyone was, I've never seen anything like it in such a small thing live.
No, it was spectacular, and I love the idea that kind of choreography or dance could almost dictate the music, as opposed to the normal sense where music tends to, you know, lead the choreography. And it's really, really interesting to see. And she put on such an amazing. It's the second time she'd done this performance ever, I think. The last time being at TED last week.
It was supposed to be, I think, pretty much completely improvised as well, which was pretty amazing. And like, she just sort of record music and then sort of make it, you know, sound like it was in a tiny little box, and then sort of just throw it back at you, and the music would just start. Anyway, so
Blaine,
you really should have been there, listeners.
Yeah, it's a shame. But we are going to talk to her later on, and she's going to explain how all this works, how they develop this tech. And it's going to be pretty amazing, so do listen out for that after the news, which we're now going to start. First, I want to quickly mention the stuff that's been going on with News Corp. I imagine everyone's probably aware of it who's listening, but it was a pretty amazing afternoon for anyone watching the live stream. Tom Watson grilled Murdoch.
He was forensic in his questioning. He was impressive.
He was brilliant. I mean, he started trending on Twitter, MP Tom Watson, this is, because I think his questioning was just probably the finest questioning of the entire hearing. I mean, he was so direct and so to the point.
And he was very well prepared as well.
Yeah, and that was really evident compared with many of the other members of the committee about how much better prepared he was.
He really was. And it was obviously a bit unfortunate that some, I don't want to say the word I was about to say, but some rascal came in with a bunch of shaving foam on a plate.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that was, again, something I sort of turned away from my screen because we were all watching the live stream kind of transfixed. Sort of turned away and heard this kerfuffle going on in my ears. I'm like, what the hell was that? And there was Murdoch sort of covered in a white substance, as the BBC recorded.
And Wendy smacking her assailant with a right fist. That was impressive.
But the main point of all this is that Murdoch has basically denied responsibility for the phone hacking scandal. Yeah. He was asked by Labour MP Jim Sheridan, do you accept that you ultimately are responsible for this whole fiasco? To which Murdoch replied, no. And saying that the people responsible were, quote, the people I trust to run the company and the people they trusted. And to be fair, I kind of do sort of side with that argument, because he was saying that News of the World accounts for less than 1% of News Corp's incoming revenue. And so if a part of your company is only accountable for 1%, you have like 50,000 employees, it's not necessarily surprising that he didn't know a person that one of those people were speaking to.
And people do get put in positions of responsibility. I mean, you don't, when something goes wrong in a company, you don't sack everyone at the top. They've already got rid of Rebecca Brooks. They've got rid of the whole of the News of the World team, and they've got rid of Les Hinton, who's been there for decades. I think it, you know, it doesn't make sense to keep on going up the food chain until we've got, you know, David Cameron or whoever else is at the top of this.
It's an enormous victory for Tom Watson, because it's been personal between him and, well, particularly Rebecca Brooks for a long time. Ever since he signed a letter calling for Tony Blair to quit, it kind of put him in her sights, and the two of them have been feuding on and off ever since. And I think that's very definitely the foundations for his participation in these phone hacking investigations.
Well, we've got a summary piece on the site in quite a lot of detail that Liv, you wrote on the day. And we also have a profile on Tom Watson that Duncan put together, if you're interested in finding out a bit more about Watson's involvement in this sort of digital landscape, I suppose.
Yeah, he's heavily involved in all aspects of digital politics, but it's not the only aspect of his career. So if you're interested in the other stuff, then do go have a look.
Yep, search for Murdoch and you'll find it. Anyway, let's move on to some slightly more lighthearted news. OS X Lion revolutionised everything this week by coming out.
You promised me you were going to roar when you introduced this
piece. I said I wasn't going to
roar. I want a roar. Can you give us a roar?
Roar. There you go.
That's pretty good.
That's all you're getting. So OS X Lion was released earlier this week, a couple of days ago on Wednesday.
Has it revolutionised, or has it just improved a little bit on iterations?
That was a little bit of deliberate hyperbole on my part. It's the latest version of Mac OS. It comes with a lot of fairly neat features. iTunes is a hell of a lot faster. And there are a lot of similarities between the iPad and how the iPad's UI works in terms of swiping and gestures and kind of a all-encompassing home screen of apps and things like that. They brought a lot of what Apple has done well on the iPad and brought that into Lion. Some people like it, some people don't. But generally speaking, the response has been very positive. And in the UK, it's just over £20. So it's quite a cheap acquisition. And the white MacBook, the plastic one, has been killed. The new MacBook Airs were updated this week with backlit keyboards and faster processors and things. And the traditional white MacBook is no longer. So it's either MacBook Air or MacBook Pro.
And that's it.
Apple is the only company where it's a news story if you introduce or get rid of a certain coloured product. You never have Topshop or Uniqlo or anyone saying, we've now got tops in red, you know, and this is a news story.
No, because there's loads of those. But they would be a new big story if they say, we're not selling jeans anymore.
Well, that's true. But no, but
or
in terms
we're selling jeans, but you have to buy individual legs only, and you have to 3D print them.
It's not quite like that.
No, it's not. But we've talked about the product enough. There was something interesting that came out of the news this week that, Duncan, you wrote about. Fake Apple stores in China.
That's right. In a city called Kunming in southwest China, a US blogger living there who goes by the name Bird Abroad noticed what she thought was an Apple store or an Apple premium reseller popping up in her town. And it had the traditional Apple store, you know, airy interior with blue-shirted staff and name badges around the necks and products to play with.
Logos everywhere.
Logos everywhere, exactly. And it turned out to be a ripoff of a genuine Apple store.
It's so bizarre. There are these photos and these employees that this lady spoke to genuinely believed they worked for Apple.
Oh, the employees believed
they thought they worked for Apple. And to be honest, if you look at these stores, you wouldn't. If someone said this is the new Apple store in Kunming, you wouldn't say, oh, that looks a bit odd. Yeah. It looks exactly the same. All the sort of treatment of the posters and everything, they were the same images.
And the way there's just like products sat on tables around the room.
Everything was the same. Now, we don't know if the products themselves are counterfeit products or anything like that. But I did manage to find out that these are unauthorized Apple stores.
This isn't a premium reseller
taking the job far too seriously, as we previously thought. Yeah. It does seem that these are dodgy stores, and there are more than one of them. There were a few of these discovered. But Liv, you were saying earlier on, before we start recording, that there are a lot of stores like this.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who's been travelling around Asia, you'll probably have noticed there's lots of kind of rip-offs of things like McDonald's or Burger King's, maybe with a slightly different spelling, but generally, you know, providing the same sorts of services and products. But I think this kind of takes it up a notch, you know, to the fact that the very staff even thought they were working for the real thing is hilarious.
Well, I think that's enough Apple for today. Let's jump to the other side of the camp, sort of. Bill Gates Microsoft man once was.
Former Microsoft man.
I thought what you were going to do there was say from Apple to poo, the other side of the digestive system.
Oh, my God. I'm so not editing that out, even though I should. Yes, well, anyway, that. Bill Gates wants to reinvent the toilet, Liv. Please tell me about this because it sounds amazing.
Yeah, well, it's the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and they've launched this $42 million program which aims to reinvent the toilet. And the idea is to address the fact that 40% of the world's population don't have access to a clean and safe toilet. So they might go out in the open, and this filters into the water system. And so you end up drinking this horrible diseased water. And they're saying that this contributes to as many as 1.4 million deaths of children each year from diarrhea-related diseases. So what they're doing is they're offering grants through a number of different sub-organisations to fund innovations in the capture and storage of waste, as well as processing it into things like renewable energy or fertiliser and things that they might be able to even sell on.
So they're providing grants for people to do this themselves, yeah, essentially.
And try and find ways to provide nice, clean, safe toilets in places where you don't have the infrastructure that all of us appreciate over here.
So what could a reinvented toilet take the form of? What is one way that this could manifest itself?
Well, there's one very cool project, a company called Luwot, that I saw a couple of weeks ago, who've already received funding from the foundation. And what they do is they have this very Western-looking toilet, but instead of water, they have this bowl made out of this biodegradable kind of plastic. And you go to the loo, and then you do the flush action. Instead of producing water, it moves this plastic kind of bag down and then seals it with heat into this kind of hermetically sealed poo parcel, which goes into a chamber below, and this can carry on happening. So none of the smells, there's not a kind of cesspool of disgustingness underneath the bowl. It all gets sealed, and then you put these little parcels, which are, again, not very unpleasant because they're all sealed up, into a digester, and it takes about 4 weeks, and it turns it into natural gas, which you can use for cooking or anything.
It's amazing. It reminds me a little tiny bit of what Tom Good did on The Good Life,
yeah,
where he made a generator thing in his basement that turned pig waste into electricity. Anyway, do we have any kind of time frame maybe for how long it could be until we see some of these things? I mean, apparently there are a billion people defecating in public, at least in the open, around the world, which just seems ridiculous that it's that high.
There's a UN directive for 2015, and I can't actually remember what it is now. Oh, it's the United Nations 2015 Millennium Development Goal to reduce by half the number of people who don't have access to basic sanitation.
So we're almost talking in 4 years.
In 4 years' time, to try and bring that number down.
And I guess the key point about all of this is the technology has to scale.
Yeah, exactly. It has to be scalable, it has to be cheap. They're trying to find systems that cost no more than 5 cents per person per day and are simple to install and maintain. I mean, there's no point coming up with this incredible supersonic toilet that produces, some kind of hydrogen fuel cell energy if the people in Rwanda aren't going to be able to afford it or install it. People always talk about clean water, but they don't really talk about it in terms of like sewage. They talk about the drinking water, but this is just as, if not more, important.
We're going to take a quick break now, and when we come back, we're going to talk about a new initiative to re-measure the height of Everest.
Registration for the Wire 2011 Summit is now open. Don't miss your chance to hear some of the most inspiring talks from thought leaders of the wired world over 2 days this October in London. For more information, please visit wiredevent.co.uk.
So, that big hill that a lot of people have wandered up without any aid or assistance, we're not necessarily sure how big it is, actually. Everest, I'm talking about. Duncan doesn't believe it's a big hill. He says it's a giant mountain, which is probably more accurate but less amusing. There is a new initiative, I believe, to measure it.
Yeah, there's a bit of a dispute about how massive this giant hill is. China and Nepal have long had a disagreement over whether the measured height should include the snow that rests on top of the rock at the top of the mountain, which at the moment adds about 3.5 meters to the height, which the Chinese calculated to be 8,844 meters. The Nepalese reckon it should be 8,448 meters tall.
That's being pedantic, isn't it?
it is being a wee bit pedantic, but when you're talking about the tallest mountain on Earth, and it has implications for where you draw borders around that mountain because it straddles the borders between Nepal and China, then it starts becoming a bit more important.
I've just seen that the process takes 2 years. What the hell are they doing for 2 years to measure a single mountain?
It's basically about setting up GPS stations in 3 different locations to gain a really, really precise figure, and then triangulating the measurements from those stations to eliminate the error.
Okay.
Geologists believe, I think, that the mountain, not the hill, is being pushed upwards around 4 millimeters a year.
Yeah, so I mean, this is changing fairly rapidly, but the current figure actually dates from an Indian survey in 1955. That was the first time that the 8,848 meter height was put down, and a number of different places have confirmed that since. But I think it's quite impressive that we were pretty much there back 56 years ago.
The thing is, Brian Blessed's been up there since they measured this. Surely that'll have pushed the mountain back down a bit.
Has he? I didn't know that.
Brian Blessed, hasn't he been up Everest?
Surely not the top of Everest. He might have made it to base camp.
He's the oldest man to get as high as he did. He's tried to get up Everest 3 times and failed.
But he got up a bit. Anyway, that's my point. He's been on the mountain. But this isn't about Brian Blessed. I have to say, I agree with the Chinese, because unlike snow, rock can't melt. And I don't believe necessarily that the height of a mountain should be based on stuff that can no longer be a part of that mountain.
But then what about places with glaciers? Do you then have to measure the height of the land with a glacier all over it by finding actually where the rock starts?
I don't think there are as many kind of territorial issues with glaciers, though, as there are with this. I mean, if they're talking about these few millimetres make a big difference to our international relations, then I think you should be basing it on something that's a little bit more static than the highest point of a snow mountain.
But the snow's not going anywhere. It's not like it melts every year and then reappears.
No, but it will, over a series of years, vary in height. It's been as low as, I think, 1.5 metres before.
Oh, has it?
And it's gone, and it's about 3.5 metres at the moment.
Are you a mountain? How are you measured? Let us know in the comments on our story on the website. And on that note, we are going to move swiftly from news and into our feature. Yeah, so at the start of the show, we went on quite a bit about Imogen Heap and her amazing gloves. She was at our event last night. Well, not last night, a couple of days ago, I think.
Depending on when you're listening to this.
Absolutely. And Duncan, you met up with her to talk a bit about what she was actually talking about at our event, which were these amazing gloves.
Yeah, we had a lovely chat about all kinds of innovations that are going on in the music industry right now, from the gloves, but also other instruments and other ways that smaller bands that maybe don't have the resources that Imogen has access to, that they can get their hands on and start to experiment with these different technological processes.
Cool. Well, I think it's time we hear from Imogen.
I'm here with Imogen Heap and Tom Mitchell. First of all, could the two of you describe a little bit about the project that you've got going with the gloves that we saw earlier?
Yeah, well, it began, I guess, I'm a musician and I perform on stage, and often I get very frustrated by how restrictive the gear is that I have and how expressive I can be with it. You know, you can play an instrument, you can play a piano, you can be expressive with that, you have your voice, but when it comes to filters and panning and different effects, there is no way of doing that expressively. And I was always felt very frustrated that kind of 50% of the performance that was going on kind of behind closed doors, because it was all on, you know, things that people can't see. I don't have a camera on my head, so people can't see it. And I wanted to get rid of that, so that actually by making gestures, the audience can fully understand and I can communicate what it is that I'm doing without explaining or having a camera on my head. So this is really where the gloves, the idea of making a system that I can be expressive and improvise spontaneously with came about.
And on a more technological level, how does it work? How do the gloves physically work?
Okay, so there's gloves, but there's also orientation sensors. So Imogen has a glove on each hand, one of these orientation sensors on each hand as well. And from that, we can work out which posture she's making with her hand, and also which way up her hands are, which way she's pointing. And from this, we can recognise various things, for example, drum gestures, and if she points in a direction, we can map that to notes, so she can play a keyboard as well. But also, a lots of the mode changes and the controls for the synthesizer are also controlled by postures. So we look at the data coming from the gloves, analyze it to look for a posture that maps a preset that we've already stored as a bit of training data. And then when we get a match, we perform an action, and Imogen can move her arms around on stage, and hopefully everyone can understand what's going on.
But the gloves aren't the only technological experiment you're involved in at the moment. You're experimenting all over the place. What are some of the other things you're trying out right now?
Well, this is the kind of beginning of this journey. I want to create a performance piece where I'm on stage, and maybe for an hour and a half. It's kind of separate from my songs. I will be using the gloves and beyond as part and integrated into my live show, as it is in a more kind of inverted commas typical show. But I would love to create a performance piece where the audience are actually immersed in the music, so that in some way that you have 360 surround speaker system, and that maybe in some way I can actually direct sound at you by using kind of directional speakers on the ends of my fingertips, perhaps. And then another layer of this, I'd love to create a visual layer, so that maybe when I make a note in the sky with my finger, you see out of it, maybe a ball that kind of grows bigger and kind of floats off the stage, maybe different shapes, and maybe whole kind of scenes using a Papa's Ghost, this kind of old theatre tech, where you would see a ghost on stage and you'd wonder how they appear. So using this Papa's Ghost technique, this kind of holographic type thing. And then the other layer that we want to add is to have a kind of for the system to recognise where I am on the stage. So in my head, I can kind of have a map, and I can decide when I want to go into this mode. So if I stand in a certain area on stage, I am a drum kit. When I stand in another area of the stage, I am the strings. And through the different gestures that I'm doing, relate to that mode that I'm in that part of the stage. So this way, hopefully, the audience really, really understand what's going on. I can be really expressive and dance around and maybe even learn to body pop to get the drums really in time and expressive. So that's the kind of long-term, for me, performance side of things.
So I guess it's about taking music away from being just a static thing on a record and making it much more expressive, much more of a living thing. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, live in itself is a living thing when you go to perform a live show, but often because, I'm only one person, there's only so much one person can do, because you've been restricted in the past to certain pieces of gear that only do certain things. But with Tom, we're creating a system that's kind of fully integrating everything, and that's really responsive, really like hardly any latency, which is one of the major problems with looping, especially on stage. And so with this, creating a really robust system that we can add to and widen
More and more bands are working with apps these days, and companies like RJDJ are making that possible. How do you see the future of the listening to music experience changing and becoming more interactive, I guess?
Definitely, I'm all up for that. I love it when you take away all the kind of difficult technical stuff and anyone can be as creative and kind of express themselves musically as anyone else, and you kind of, get rid of all the boundaries of the technical stuff, because in the end, it's not what you got, it's how you use it and the ideas that come from your head, your brain, to make music. It's all very well having lots of fancy tools, but in the end, if you don't have the inspiration and the creativity, it's not worth anything. So I think, where would I like to see music? I mean, there's this what's this website called Indaba that has a kind of platform for people to kind of collectively write music. I think that's really interesting when the world becomes, a tiny, just on one page, people from all over the world can use their talents to come together to make a song or even a film score. And it no longer, you're no longer limited by cash or by where you are in the world.
And there are going to be some bands out there who are currently just doing things in the very traditional way, guitar, bass, keyboards, etc., who want to get involved with this. What's the first step? How do you get from the traditional place to where you are today?
Well, I think a lot of people just maybe don't want to. But I mean, for them, it's very exciting playing the drums, and maybe that's all you want to do, and you do it brilliantly, and that's great. But I I just want to do more stuff. But I don't want to be kind of a puppet, kind of, you know, fiddling around in some, have to be doing it in certain order. It's just, in the end, it's just, it's really just a means to be freer on stage and to be more directly connected with the kind of the spontaneous idea that you have and being able to kind of release it as soon as possible in a form that you're happy with. So anything that cuts that down is what I'm always striving toward. Yeah.
And then finally, there's always going to be a few people who will say to you, you know, that this is that all the technology detracts from the music, that this is some sort of gimmick. How do you make sure that the creative aspects of the performance are the bits that shine forward and not the technology?
Well, I think the gloves are the epitome of that, really, because there's tons of tech behind it. But in the end, what you're left with is somebody on stage making gestures, moving around in different ways, and really just manifesting that initial idea directly. Even though there's lots of tech behind it, you don't see that, and actually it's not. It's important to us, of course, but it's not important to the audience. What's important is that you kind of understand you're better connected with the music that you're listening to and experiencing.
Great. Thank you very much, both of you, for your time.
Thank you.
Amazing. Thanks, Imogen, and thanks, Duncan, for doing that. We had quite a long day before that was recorded, so
yes, we
it's
did.
Kind of good that came together. It's amazing, though. I mean, anyone, if you ever get the chance to see this performance in person with these gloves, drop everything. It doesn't matter if it's a loved one or a priceless vase, drop them, go and see it. It's amazing. Unless it's on the internet, in which case, put them down safely and make your way to a computer. It's absolutely fantastic. Well, we also spoke to Paul Smenitsky, who is the director of digital at Universal Music Group. He was also talking at the event that we had earlier this week. And Duncan, you spoke to him to briefly talk a little bit about the musical landscape.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's quite a tough time for the major record labels right now. The music industry is splintering into all kinds of different places. And I really wanted to get his view on the view from the top, almost. Universal is the biggest record label in the world, and how they see the digital landscape and how they see which different services are important and worth looking at and how it all plays out.
Cool. Well, let's find out.
I'm here with Paul Smenitsky from Universal. First off, Paul, do you want to describe a little bit about what you do at Universal?
Sure. I'm director of digital for Universal, which is a group of labels that includes Polydor and Mercury and Island and Fiction and A&M and a really great classical division, Decca, as well. My job is pretty varied, really, quite strategic. The things that are kind of occupying me currently are things like dealing with ISPs, how can we create new partnerships, a bit of kind of government stuff, a lot of creative digital format discussions, and always close to artists.
In the discussion earlier, you described the digital landscape as a bit like the Wild West. Can you sort of talk a little bit more around that and tell me which you think the most important players in the market are today?
Well, by the Wild West, I don't mean it's full of bandits. What I mean is that there's a lot of opportunity, and it's a real exciting area, a really exciting part of our business. I think, and commercially, in terms of the business partners that are contributing most to the industry at the moment, it's probably unsurprising to know that that's iTunes. But I think they're a great partner and a great service, and it just works. And you know, there's a reason why they're so successful. But you know, they do really well. But we're always trying to kind of look over the horizon. So I think the big story of the year really has been, in the past year, has kind of been the rise of subscription and streaming services. I think one of the key challenges for us is kind of helping people make a bit of a cultural shift into being comfortable with streaming rather than owning. I think we made some really great strides there. So Spotify is the one that most people would know, but there are some really great streaming services out there, both active in the UK and active elsewhere in the world. So stuff like Mog and Ardio and Plus46 are all fantastic streaming services. I think we're probably at a point now where services kind of have to start coming through with their USPs. We don't need 15 Spotify's. What we need is, you know, 15 services that all suit a slightly different group of music fans, I think.
And you talked a bit there about these streaming services, these cloud services with giant jukeboxes in the sky. We've also seen the emergence within the last year of digital lockers. How do you view that as a business model compared to the others?
Well, I think a locker is a service. You know, it's a tool to store your music in. I guess there's the headlines will tell you there's kind of two types of locker service. There are the unlicensed ones like Amazon and Google currently, and there's the licensed ones like Apple announced recently. I think where that was really going to help artists and labels in the industry is less in the revenue that we make from the cost of the locker, but more about creating a really brilliant environment and experience that will kind of encourage people to buy more, I think, and spend a bit more on music. So it's, you know, it has to be seamless, and it's about the best possible experience for fans, I think.
Another thing you mentioned earlier in the discussion is that we're yet to nail a digital format for the digital generation. What do you think is wrong with the MP3?
I think the MP3 is a brilliant format. And really, it kind of represents the core, the node of our business, right, which is songs. But I think, you know, some people would argue that the pirates, perhaps, and others might argue that the value of an MP3 has been really diminished. And I guess in a world where there's kind of musical ubiquity, and you can, you know, if you really want a song and you don't want to pay for it, you can go out there and grab it. And, you know, we know from talking to a lot of particularly younger music fans that they want to have iPods with, you know, 20,000 tracks. They want a lot of stuff. So I think what an MP3 doesn't do is provide the context that maybe some physical formats used to do in the past. So because I'm of a certain age, you know, I have really fond memories of sitting in my room as a teenager poring over the back of Echo and the Bunnymen albums, and I could tell you where every song was recorded and who played on which track, and, you know, I could probably recite the sleeve notes. And because it was the, you know, my one purchase of the week or the month or whatever, kind of forced to spend time with the music by the things that are wrapped around it. So I think that's where we can make the MP3 a much better format. I think the amount of data that we deliver with our MP3s and audio files, and the amount of data that our partners can take and what they can do with it, could certainly be better. And that's someone that we're working on at Universal. But, you know, ownership for some people is not relevant. And I think that's why streaming and video, particularly as a format, is really important for us.
I'm glad you mentioned video, because that was my next question. With the rise of services like YouTube, video is obviously playing a much more important role. But over the history of the music industry, over, say, the last 20 years, video has served much more of a promotional role. Can you see it becoming more of a creative product in its own right in the future?
Absolutely. And, you know, the launch of Vivo in the UK has totally changed the landscape around video, I think. You know, what was really just a promotional tool, as you say, until quite recently, is now a tool that pays artists. And I think that's a great thing. I think, you know, video, for a lot of people, a lot of young people particularly, YouTube is their jukebox. So if we can facilitate their, you know, their needs musically and how they want to listen to music and help artists get paid at the same time, then I think that's a great thing.
And then finally, I was having a chat with a venture capitalist the other day, and he was saying that his company will no longer deal with music services simply because it's so much of a headache to license everything, and it's a very risky place to be. How do you think the industry can change that and make it easier for better legal services to spring up?
Well, that's an interesting viewpoint, and I think in the UK it's a bit of a fallacy. You know, we have over 70 licensed digital services in the UK. And I think that tells you that actually licensing is possible. We're in the business of bringing services to market. And I think, you know, if you were to speak to our partners, they would tell you that we've helped bring people to market by licensing. So, you know, if there's a suggestion that we're unwilling to do that, then that is definitely false. I would disagree with that. And in terms of bringing services to market, I think, you know, the services are there, and we'll continue to bring more to market. But I think it's where we're at now is a position where we need to try and plug the right people, the right music fans, into the right service for them. And I think, you know, labels and artists have got a part to play in that equation, and there's a bit of education in there, and we're still kind of figuring out in some ways the best ways to do that. But we're definitely getting there, and I think we see that every month when we kind of see how engaged, see how our business is becoming more and more digital.
Great. Thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you, Duncan. It's been an exceptional pleasure.
Thanks, Paul. Amazing. That is the best outro from any interview ever recorded in the history of humankind. I wish more interviews ended like that, but that was great. Thanks to Paul for taking the time out to speak to us. Well, on that note, we are going to end the show. But we've actually got more coming up next week on the podcast from the Future of Music event. Duncan, you spoke to somebody else.
Yes, I spoke to Michael Breidenbrucker, who was one of the founders of Last.fm, but more recently he's been working on mobile music apps, which, as long-term podcast listeners will know, is a bit of a fascination of mine. All about how the future of mobile music applications on your smartphone, on your tablet or your laptop, how that's all going to play out. But you're going to have to wait for that. It's next week.
Make sure you tune in for that. That's it for the show, as we said, for this week. So it's time to decide who I'm going to get to read out the email stuff. Liv, you haven't spoken for a few minutes.
I haven't. You can follow us on Twitter, first of all. We're on at Wired UK. Nate is at Nate Langson. Duncan is at Duncan Gear. And I am, as ever, at Olivia _ Solon.
And we've got a Facebook page. It kicks ass.
We do. It's at facebook.com/WiredUK.
And if you want to send us an email, if you are a mountain, as we mentioned earlier, and would like to tell us how you would like to be measured, send us an email, podcast@wired.co.uk. It is the home for opinion and discussion.
No one sent us any secrets after I asked for them the other week.
Yeah, if you're a secret, please send yourself. Yeah. And we will speak to you all again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Liv, I do like your T-shirt. Drugs, not pugs.
Pugs, not drugs.
Is that what I said?
You said drugs, not pugs. I mean, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think you can have pugs and drugs, but this is...
Don't do pugs, kids. Drugs. Don't do. Let's just start the show.